Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with the New York State Certified Seal. It's food that is grown right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
And Jimmy, we have not done what we just did in 5 months,
I
think,
since
August.
Check it out. Welcome back to us.
Welcome back to us. If you are a subscriber to The Front Burner and thought maybe we had just vanished from the face of the earth and all of a sudden we popped up in your feed, it's because we had some work things to do in the fall. We've done them, and we are now back. We'll be here for a full season and hopefully for the full year and for many years to come. So really glad to be back and have a great guest today. It's Chef Mark Ladner. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for the invite.
Mark, as many of our listeners I'm sure know, has been the chef at Del Posto restaurant in New York City since it opened in 2005. Before that, of Lupa, also in New York City. He's also the author of the recently published Del Posto cookbook, and it was just announced almost on Christmas Eve that Mark is going to be leaving the restaurant to launch a quick-serve, gluten-free pasta concept called Pasta Flyer. And here to talk about all that and some other topics that are in the news is Mark, and we're going to just jump into the moment we find ourselves in right now just to sort of orient our listeners, let them know kind of where you are. Is it still operative in the Times piece that kind of broke the news? It said you were leaving Del Posto at the end of January. Is that still?
I am leaving Del
that
Posto
is the
at
case.
The end of January, yes.
So how are you after, not only all this time at that one restaurant, but all that time in restaurants, Lupa before that.
Yeah, I've been with Mario and Joe for over 18 years.
Yeah. So as you're at the kind of precipice of this change,
yeah.
Just if you don't mind me asking, how are you excited, butterflies? How are you feeling as you sit here today?
It's an emotional time. I'm certainly excited for the future. This is a project I've been working on for a long time. It's also very different from fine dining, so there's those apprehensions. But, for the most part, I'm really looking forward to the future. I'm really excited about this concept. And it's time for me now, so
yeah,
it's time.
Great.
Yeah.
So can you tell us, it's been in the news, but just in your words, as you talk to people about Pasta Flyer, how do you define it and explain it to people?
Well, obviously it's a fast food concept that is pasta based. I'm trying to embrace a lot of the food, wine, and cultural aspects that I've always loved about Italy.
Mm-hmm.
I've been focused on that culture for the last 20 years or more. So, for the last 12 years at Del Posto, I've been, doing... really expensive, sequestered fine dining. And I really miss, the more inclusive, affordable style of food. I think that Italian food culture is inherently healthy and nourishing. And those are the aspects that I'm hoping to focus on with this new concept and this new food. So yeah, I've been thinking about this for a long time. And obviously there's a lot of great examples out there right now of healthy food that you can get fast.
Yeah.
But, you know, nobody seems to have cracked the code on pasta yet.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of great competition, at least in my opinion, for that. I've figured out a way to cook, you know, essentially al dente pasta in about 10 to 12 seconds.
Amazing.
So, you know, it's a pretty intuitive sort of cue system, like you've seen at many other fast casual restaurants.
Right.
But it's really fast.
What prompted the gluten-free aspect of this?
At the time, in 2014, when my partner and I were first putting together sort of the blueprint for the concept, you know, gluten-free was really a big thing. And we sort of thought that it would be a nice time. You know, I at Del Posto and fine dining, you know, at the price point that we exist there, you know, no has never been an option. So I've been sort of in the front lines of dietary preference, as we call it, for quite some time. So I've been navigating those waters for, you know, almost a decade. So I realized that if I was going to do something like this, especially in 2014, it was necessary to be sort of inclusive in that way. Fortunately, it seems to have subsided, at least the fad aspect of it. I mean, certainly, you know, celiac is an immune deficiency disease, and that's not going away, but it's a very, very small percentage of the population. So we certainly still have gluten-free, but we also have other types of pasta. So it won't be a certified gluten-free environment.
Got it.
But there is a lot of food that is inherently gluten-free there.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me, and just a quick aside, you know, I recently, just through some observations in my own life, have become convinced that I have maybe a gluten sensitivity or intolerance of some kind.
It's certainly possible. I mean,
just these little minor maladies that have been unexplained, and I've noticed they get worse if I've had, you know, big pasta dinner or bread. And I've started experimenting, just cutting it out of my diet. And it's interesting. I mean, I think it probably, my sense is, more and more people are going to find out that it affects them in some way, if it doesn't rise to the level of that.
I also have some theories, you know, surrounding this, having, you know, researched it pretty extensively for the last few years. You know, a lot of this sensitivity that people seem to suffer from, I mean, first and foremost, you know, it's a very individual thing, and whatever makes you feel better is, you know, what I would advise people to do.
Yeah.
But I also feel that, you know, the processed food industry and the way that gluten and bleached and brominated flour has been treated for the last, you know, several decades is not something that is easily digested by the human animal. And I think there's been a lot of really exciting, you know, developments in baking and pastry and pasta over the last few years, where, you know, people are sourcing better grains that are, you know, more natural. And then obviously you've seen this new milling craze where you're getting better access to a lot of these nutrients. You know, a lot of the processed food industry, like Wonder Bread, for example, right? In an effort to reduce the time spent on natural fermentation, they're using like Vital Wheat Gluten and things like that that just spike.
Right. Just crappy.
Yeah.
Crappy ingredients.
It's just hard to digest that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really exciting to see so many other people out there in the industry embracing, you know, natural fermentation and better sourcing of grains in general.
Yeah.
When did the, I know you did the pop-up in 2014. What's the birth of the original idea? How long has this been in your head?
Probably about 5 years. When I was, after I had done Otto Enoteca Pizzeria with Mario and Joe in 2002, I had wanted to go even further sort of down market and do something similar to this. The idea didn't necessarily exist then, but I knew I wanted to, you know, do something that was even more inclusive. and then they presented me with the opportunity to do Del Posto, which I couldn't resist, and has obviously been an incredible experience for me. But I would say no less than 5 years.
Very cool.
And it started as a hobby, and then I've been working on it full time for at least 2 years.
Very cool. We want to talk about Pasta Flyer a little more, but I want to get back to some of that other stuff from your earlier career. You know, like you've said, you've been with Joe Amaro for 18 years, mm-hmm. and you've been doing the Italian, and mm-hmm. was pasta always your thing? And then I guess I was reading a little bit about some influences that you might have taken from Japanese culture or ramen places. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about
that? That's more of like the dining culture of, like, you know, the Azakaya or the Yakitori. Those sorts of places are just like really fun and really casual, and the culture really permits and, you know, really encourages a really wonderful sort of environment around the table and celebration of food and drink and that sort of thing, which I love. Part of, you know, one of the things that I found in Japanese culture that I wasn't able to find in Italy, for example, were, you know, efficient ways to serve pasta fast, right? Certainly ramen culture in Japan and other parts of Asia is very fast, it's very wholesome, it's very healthy, and you don't really find that very much in Italy. So that informed a lot of the concept early on. But the food has never been really like fusion. It's always been, you know, pretty traditionally Italian.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you just speak a little? I mean, I was really, first of all, the animation piece of your Kickstarter that did is charming. I just love it. But can you talk about, this is something, well, two things, I guess. One, you know, there's a lot about where you are right now that seems to really dovetail with some things that are going on industry-wide, right?
Sure.
Julia Moskin wrote that piece, Breaking This News in the Times, and kind of pointed to this. And you and I just met, but I kind of love that you just used the term fast food, right? Because mm-hmm. there's quick serve, there's fast casual.
I'm not afraid.
Yeah, but I love that you just said fast food. Yeah. I mean, good for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, that it does seem to have become, for a lot of chefs, sort of this holy grail or this piece of the puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. To have this perhaps economically more lucrative concept, an exportable, replicable,
multi-unit, scalable,
multi-unit thing. Do you find yourself talking to a lot of other people with your background who are, without naming names, but that are interested in this? Do you perceive this as something that's very much sort of in the air amongst, you know, your peers and your colleagues?
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody is trying to find creative ways to navigate a lot of the issues that are affecting our industry right now. You know, in New York, for example, especially like real estate and labor and things like this. You know, also a lot of chefs have these strategies where, you know, they have like a flagship or they have some sort of fine dining restaurant, and then they, in an effort to extend their brand, they do all these other types of things. I just wanted to say that, you know, that is not in any way my intention. Like, I am leaving fine dining to focus the amount of energy and attention that I once focused on that on affordable dining.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It's a completely different thing.
How do you... Go ahead, Jimmy.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, if history's taught us anything, it's going to be a real success.
I hope so. Damn. You know, got a lot riding on it. So.
How do you look at it, Mark? You know, you look at the kind of this, like, pendulum swing almost from like, well, but not just now, right? You did, Jimmy and I were talking before, you were at Otto, you did Lupa.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most interesting stories out there, you know, going from, you know, sous chef at Babbo, opening Lupa as the chef. Lupa, you know, was just a wildly beloved, acclaimed Roman trattoria neighborhood joint, you know?
Yeah, it really
was. Amazing cooks came up out of that kitchen, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was nothing that wasn't just great for years and years and years. I mean, I'm not saying it isn't now still.
No, it's still great.
You know,
it
your
is.
Time there was a remarkable time spent. Then to to bop into Oto, which again is probably a little bit more like a neighborhood joint, and then to find your way to Del Posto, you know, New York's only four-star Italian restaurant. That to me is just such a fascinating story. I mean, you alluded to Joe and Mario presenting you the idea. I was wondering whose idea that was, you know, one of my questions.
It was their idea. I mean, they had been working on it for a long time. You know, Joe likes to refer to it as a successful real estate deal, ultimately, is why it ended up working out.
Right.
Well, a lot of good restaurants start that way.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, it was a very difficult learning curve and a process that took a long time. You know, a lot of people in this day and age seem to have the patience that it takes to build these sorts of teams and cultures sometimes. You know, often, regardless of, you know, the type of world we live in now, with immediate gratification being expected, sometimes there is just no shortcut for time.
Right. Like, there's no elevator to success. Yeah. You got to take the stairs.
It takes time.
Do you, but as you look, so on the surface, it would seem that what you're doing now is a huge departure, right?
Sure.
But this arc that we're talking about of your career, it does seem that you are somebody who's very much intrigued by new challenges. This is what it seems like from afar, right?
Yes.
So you do something like Lupa, mm-hmm. and then you do something like Del Posto.
Mm-hmm.
Is this new concept for you just, do you see it as much of a departure as it may seem, or does it just sort of seem like the next thing that you're kind of getting your hooks into and trying to solve and take on?
It seems like just the next, evolution for me, because I intend in every way to put the same amount of energy and sort of brain trust in this that I've put in any of the other projects that I've done in my career. But I've always preferred, you know, casual dining like Red Cat, for example.
Thank you.
You know, when I first moved to New York in 93, the dining climate was much different. It was still very Francophile,
mm-hmm.
as I'm sure you well know. But I was really, really into more of the casual renaissance that was happening with places like Poe.
Yeah.
I worked, and that was in fact the reason why I ended up approaching Mario to work with him. I was really into that 25 and under.
Yeah. Like Poe, like Blue Ribbon.
Yep.
You know, there wasn't a whole, what's going on now with the casual. It was really at the forefront in the 90s.
I worked at this place called, I opened this place called Indigo with Scott Bryan.
Great restaurant.
I love that place. I also worked with Willie Prunty, mm-hmm. who was in charge of all those Jean Claude places.
Sure.
And I opened Liam, which actually turned into Lupa.
Right.
So I was trying to work with Mario to complete that trilogy and hopefully go into that sort of thing.
I didn't connect those
and
dots.
And then just the climate changed drastically.
Right.
You know,
a couple times since then.
Yeah.
So can you just, I started to ask this before, the whole Kickstarter experience.
Yes.
This is again something when I say, mm-hmm. you know, your sort of moment right now, it seems like all these threads kind of flow through it, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have tried to do the Kickstarter thing. Mm-hmm. Can you just briefly talk about why did you decide to try to go that route? And then B, what was that experience like for you?
It's incredibly hard, and it's important to mention first and foremost that Kickstarter is not free money, so don't fool yourself.
What do you mean by that?
I think a lot of people are under the impression that you just sort of like float this idea and people just send you money and it's like free money. It's capital without giving up any equity, obviously. My partner, Nastasia Lopez, known around these parts as the Hammer on Cooking Issues, is an expert at the Kickstarter. She had done one with Dave with the Searsall, and then also with she ran the one for MoFad as well when they were raising money. So she really knew her way around this already. But it's a tremendous amount of work. There's a lot of correspondence that happens. You're also giving away something in return for the capital, in terms of like gifts or some sort of like property, and that all has inherent costs that a lot of people don't factor in. Like for example, if somebody is putting some sort of product on Kickstarter, you know, God forbid they don't factor in the cost of like then selling that whatever, I mean, sending that product around the country to all these people, you can actually end up in debt if you don't do it right with a Kickstarter campaign. But, you know, it was really mostly for marketing. Mm-hmm. Rather than for the capital itself.
Got it.
So a much smaller percentage of capital raised came from Kickstarter than from you raising money.
Well, we had some sponsorships that were incredibly helpful. You know, it wasn't a very expensive proposition to begin with. It also coincided with some other engagements, cooking engagements, speaking engagements, things like that.
Right.
So, I mean, it was a lot of work, but it was super fun, and we tried to, you know, do as many sort of activities as we could when we were in these cities. But we ended up doing 6 cities in 6 months.
Wow.
How many days in each city?
Between, like, well, we, like, served on the campus of Harvard for, I think, 5 days. But like in Philadelphia, we wised up after a while. We started in a truck, and then we started sort of borrowing restaurants. We worked with Eli Culp at Fork and in Philadelphia, and then also Toki Underground, which is a ramen shop in DC. It was also super fun. We did actually a mashup with Superiority Burger.
Oh, cool.
So that was really fun.
Neat.
It was before
got the band back together.
Yeah, well, that was even before both of them were fully realized. So that was a really fun time with Brooks. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Why the first store in New York?
Because it's where I live.
That's where you live. Well said. Yeah,
there's no other reason than that.
Well, I just, you know, the outside markets could do different things. Maybe be more affordable, and you know, there's lots of different ideas or reasons. And also, you know, I read somewhere that you were thinking about it being scalable to, you know, cities or second cities.
We'll see. I mean, I'm just have to focus on making this one great first. I really don't know what the growth sort of plan is.
What you mentioned sponsorship. Mm-hmm. What is that? What's the difference between a sponsorship and an equity buy?
Well, it was like a more like a branding opportunity. So, for example, like Breville gave us some equipment and some money. We put a giant sticker on our trailer. Pat LaFreda gave me some product and some money, and he got a giant sticker on the trailer. Uh-huh. Stuff like that. So that was incredibly helpful. Incredibly helpful.
Excellent.
Great. Since you're kind of right off the heels of the realization of it, I'd love to you just had your cookbook experience.
Yes.
What was if I just throw it out there broadly, the experience of doing the cookbook, of seeing it enter the marketplace?
Yeah.
What's the first stuff that comes to mind for you?
I mean, that was also a very long project, close to 5 years. Really the highlight of the project was getting to work with my close friend Michael Wilson, mm-hmm. formerly of Cucina Italiano, and he's really responsible for the majority of the work. But you know, in a lot of ways, it was sort of for posterity, just documenting the time that I spent at Del Posto. Really wanted to sort of get that down. I also wanted to have an opportunity to celebrate, you know, more traditional throwback fine dining food that you don't see a lot these days, that I'm still very much in love with.
Yeah.
So that was fun. Celebrating, you know, traditions that are being lost in a lot of ways. They need to be recognized and celebrated for lots of reasons.
You're talking about as much about the experience of dining as you are of the food. You're strictly talking about the food.
When more about like traditional Italian regional cuisine.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you said, you know, for posterity. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had this talk with a lot of, you know, people ask me all the time, how come every chef wants a cookbook? And at some point it hit me, and I don't even know that most chefs realize or even say what you just said, mm-hmm. but it's that old cliche, right? You have to prove what you do every day. Every day, the food gets created and mm-hmm. it gets eaten. Mm-hmm. And then you start over the next day, and at some point, restaurants are gone. Mm-hmm. Menus change, mm-hmm. styles change, the food's gone.
Yeah.
The food itself
and
is gone.
And things have never been evolving and as quickly as they are now.
Right. And books, really, I mean, now there's documentaries, I guess, you know, but historically books have been, that's the museums, yeah. right? I mean, that's where it lives on.
Well, it's also, you know, a little bit like a journal. Like, when like to Mark's point, when everything's evolving so quickly, I often forget what we were doing, and I'll say, absolutely. What about this or what about that? And somebody next to me on my team will be like, yeah, we used to do it like that, not like this. And, and like, I made the thing up. So then there's somebody in the room telling me how we used to do it. So there's a certain documentation to it that really, you know, is helpful and also is nostalgic and neat to possess.
Well, I can't remember if it was on this show or when I interviewed him for my blog for Tokeland, but David Kinch tells this great story that you know, he did the Manresa cookbook, and by the book came out, when it came out, everything, the whole menu had changed.
So the book
was almost felt old to him.
He'd be making the dirt a different way
when it hit when it hit the presses. It almost felt dated to him. It's fascinating.
That's a wildly unique one, though. I mean, his stuff moves quickly.
It happened to us as well, because we sort of did it in an unorthodox way where we shot the food first and then went back and engineered all the recipes to the photography.
Why? Can you tell us?
It had to do with timing, but also we were trying to take, I mean, unbeknownst to me initially, you know, our recipes were crap. Like, restaurant recipes that you're working from on a daily basis tend to be crap, at least as the...
Well, for the home cook.
For the home
cook. Because your cooks are used to your style and know what you want and how you want it,
So we had to go back and re-engineer all those recipes, and the challenge was to do that without dumbing it down. So really what we ended up producing were these really long recipes. They weren't necessarily hard, but they're just long, because when you want to document these pretty elaborate processes... It takes a lot of words.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Yeah. We jump back into Pasta Flyer for a second. So the concept's in the Village, right? It's in 6th Avenue?
Yeah, it's
Avenue.
On 6th Avenue between 13th and 14th Street. It's under construction right now, about a month away or so.
Is it going to have seats?
Yeah, it has 30 seats. It's a pretty small dining room, but we're hoping to do a lot of, you know, takeout and delivery as well.
And will you have service, or is it just you order at the counter?
Yeah, it's
and...
just like order at the counter, yeah.
Got it.
I mean, I'll be working there full time, and it's going to be my job.
Well, next week, I knew you were leaving, so I made a reservation at Del Posto.
I look forward to it.
But other than that, I walk to work, and when I do, I walk right by your store. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't get from my house to my store without going by it, so I'm going to come check you out often.
Fantastic. I look forward to it.
Awesome. Well, we are talking with Chef Mark Ladner, currently of Del Posto, soon to be of Pasta Flyer. I guess maybe currently of both and soon to be only of Pasta Flyer. We're going to take a break in a moment. But first, just a reminder, since we are just newly back on the air, if you enjoy the show, please, we encourage you to subscribe on iTunes or elsewhere. Also, we would love... an iTunes review. I'm going back, Jimmy. I'm going to start pleading the case for the iTunes review.
Working the hustle, Andrew. Working the hustle.
And when we come back, we're a week from Inauguration Day. And without getting too explicitly political, we are going to talk a little about chefs and politics when the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew comes right back.
And this one is Greenwood Cemetery by Teeth People. We'll be right back. New York chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified Seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
Why don't you buy it? There's a story to tell about the empty
Welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We are talking with Chef Mark Ladner of Del Posto and Pasta Flyer. And this show is originating on 8 days prior to Inauguration Day. Obviously, it's a bit of a hot topic for a lot of people. We're going to not get too explicitly into anyone's individual politics, but there are a couple of stories that were happening, Jimmy, kind of in the recent past, right before the season began, that seemed like things we wanted to talk about. They seemed to dovetail with the subject of politics. Mm-hmm. One was, you know, it is very striking that a number of very high-profile chefs put their opinions out there in a big way on social media, in interviews. You know, these are people who need people coming into their businesses on a daily basis. A lot of these people have television contracts, have books to sell. I mean, they have a lot at stake. And I'm thinking about people like, you know, Tom Colicchio, who I've told personally I admire. I think he probably tweets more about politics than he does about his business.
Yeah, he absolutely does.
Andrew Zimmern puts it out there. Hugh Atchison puts it out there.
Jose Andres
is personally almost trolling Donald Trump with this lawsuit that they have going on over the deal that he pulled out of after some comments that were made at the beginning of the campaign.
Mike Simon and the whole Cleveland doesn't welcome Donald Trump.
Yeah, it is. I realize I'm talking exclusively about people on the left. It's only because I was poking around. I didn't see anybody putting it out there on the other side, although I'm sure there are people who have those you know, opinions and beliefs. But can you guys maybe both, just for people listening, what are the risks for chefs doing that? Because it seems to me to be kind of a bold thing to do.
I'm not sure anyone really knows. I mean, the only firsthand example I really have is when Mario made some comments back in 2008 after the financial collapse. And we were definitely impacted by it financially.
Mm-hmm.
But
oh, this is the banker.
Yeah.
Made a comment about bankers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it can, I mean, I guess it has a lot to do with how, you know, your profile in the public and what your, you know, constituency and customers feel about your political leanings. But, yeah, it's risky. And I don't think, you know, most chefs haven't really had access to any sort of platform like this in
this
the
is kind
past.
Of a new
so
thing.
It's a new thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Does it seem like it's something, I mean, all these people I just listed,
well,
I guess they have. It's funny they have larger followings because they have bigger platforms and more businesses, and they have tentacles that reach into like television and
right,
books.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to me, and I don't think it makes it any less laudable, but I think, you know, the people who are in a position to do this are also in a position maybe to take a little bit of a hit or
yeah,
to be.
That's
or
one
to,
sided though, you know, because you have more followings or followers, are they customers, you know? I guess the way I was thinking about it is it's one thing to, you know, have a point of view personally. It's another thing to have your business have a point of view.
Mm.
Most restaurants don't have a point of view because we serve everybody and it's not up to us. It's like that thing, well, I won't even go into it, but anyway, if it hurts the staff,
yeah,
it's not good. If it lowers revenue, it's going to lower everything. So it's going to lower your ability to have your staff make money from the guests and also how much money you pay your staff. Repairs and maintenance, you know, lack of cash flow is a crippling agent in the restaurant business.
Of course.
Because we live day to day, dollar to dollar, with some of the smallest margins there are, which, you know, coincidentally makes it more laudable to stick your neck out there.
Right.
But, you know, if you sticking your neck out there has people that help you and support you made to be wanting or to suffer, what do you get from it? You know, where's the payback? There was another point, you know, again, maybe it's a negative point. Chick-fil-A, you know, the guy who owns Chick-fil-A, there was a big gay rights thing and
yeah.
He came out and he was like, no, we don't play by those rules. You know, I forget what it was. I don't think it was the bathroom thing, but it was a
I don't remember
LGBT
exactly.
Topic.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, you know, he was Southern Christian. This is how we do it. And, you know, he's still being sued for it. It's his prerogative, and he can spend his money however he wants. But right. I have to imagine that hurt his growth and development in some areas. Maybe it accelerated in other areas.
Right.
But then, you know, if the staff isn't being rewarded as properly as they could have been or should have been, it can't be good for morale, and that's a trickle-down that the customer will feel eventually.
The other thing that you had important, worth mentioning, is that all those names that you listed are not only chefs, but they're also celebrities.
Yeah. Right.
So that's a different thing in and of itself.
But does that make it, do you think, more? To me, that would mean they have even more at stake when they stick their
head. Like, members of the entertainment community have always sort of voiced right. their political concerns over the years, right? I mean, right. you saw what Meryl Streep said the other day.
Right.
Right. With the exception of the recent Clint Eastwood thing of the Republic, not even so recent, a lot of it is, you know, Hollywood is left. You know, television and movies are left, if that's right. where you make your money. I mean, certainly the right would say that, with the, you know, exception of Fox News.
Right. So along the same lines or same umbrella topic, you know, the politics within the industry, there was Pete Wells, who started reviewing restaurants outside of New York City, reviewed Local, which is a group of restaurants that Roy Choi and Dan Patterson have started doing. It's to put certain type of food and also job opportunities in neighborhoods where maybe those things weren't as prevalent as they should be, food deserts, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And Pete went out and gave a review and gave it no stars. And I have been, that in itself was very striking. But also the backlash and not only from chefs. I saw Nancy Silverton actually took to Twitter to say something. But also, as someone who writes, I'm always struck when, you know, there's sort of writer on writer or journalist on journalist.
Yeah.
Violence, right? You know, literary violence. But, you know, Evan Kleinman, who hosts the great show Good Food out in L.A., was very direct in a tweet to Pete. Jonathan Gold wrote sort of a more measured but longer piece. There have been think pieces about it out there. You know, to me, the sort of crux of the issue is... I mean, I know a lot of people find it odd that, you know, a critic from New York was out there of all the places to review. He took on and really criticized this thing that seems to have its heart very much in the right place. That seems to be an issue. The larger philosophical issue to me is there or should there be such a thing as a non-reviewable restaurant? Like, that to me seems to be part of the question. I mean, Jonathan Gold's take I thought was interesting. It was sort of, he was within his rights to do it, but the word he used was ungenerous. It was an ungenerous thing to do. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, it's funny.
And ergo, like you and I were speaking about it earlier, how does this serve the public interest?
Right.
It
is a restaurant. It is open for question. Business. So does that, and it's by two very high profile chefs.
And they seem very committed to the project, too. It's not like a...
They are. But the project does get a lot. And it's funny, the comments that I was looking at one of the pieces Eater's done on it. And there were there was a real debate happening in the comments, which is it wasn't just a lot of people.
But like, not about the food. It seemed like everybody was saying the same thing about the food.
Well, people were pointing out things that, you know, like it's gotten a lot of press, but very little of it has actually been, and I don't mean good or bad, but very little of it has been critical. Very little of it has evaluated the food. It's almost like the food was like a collateral issue, but it is a restaurant you're talking about. So I don't know. What do you guys think about, just philosophically? I'm not asking anyone to comment on, you know, what Dan and Roy are doing directly, but you know, should there be such a thing as a restaurant that sort of, you know, exists in like a safe zone from this kind of evaluation?
If there was one, I think that would probably be it. But I haven't eaten there, so
that's very well said.
I mean, to be honest, no, nothing should be in a safe zone. Should Pete Wells from the New York Times be reviewing a fast food joint in L.A.? I wonder, you know. if Pete Wells doesn't review fast food joints in New York, or if New York has columns for quick eats or cheaper food, you know, I wonder why that's the case that he's out in L.A. doing it. But I guess because I'm older, read the New York Times, you know, his food section forever, you know, 30 plus years. It used to be that if you wanted to give somebody a smackdown, you would just not include them. And that was good enough, and everybody knew it. Everybody knew. So, like, if he went out there and wrote about another place and perhaps mentioned in one line that he was disappointed in the food of that place, albeit, you know, he did say that he thought it was current and the graphics and the design and the way it's built for the neighborhood and the music and the staff were great, you know.
Right.
Say that and then say the food was lacking,
right,
which he basically said. Again, like, if it's just going to be negative for the most part and you're just going to go to places that have celebrity ownership, because, you know, let's face it, he's not going to In-N-Out Burger. And, you know, I wonder, you know, is this the most talked about restaurant in L.A. right now? Is this the most restaurant talked about restaurant in Oakland right now? I got to question that. I have
right.
no idea.
You know, it's funny. Yeah. I mean, I had occasion to speak, and I don't know, most people listening to this may not remember it, but there was we talked about this with Peter Hoffman our last season. But there, you know, a million years ago, 1979, there was a piece, a John McPhee article in The New Yorker about a chef who had a pseudonym for the piece. McPhee called him Otto. And he operated. Do you know this piece?
No, I don't.
It was a very great big story. Deal at the time. A lot of young cooks will remember it. It was a 50.
A lot of old cooks remember it.
It was a 25,000 word piece in the New Yorker, and McPhee said he had some of the best meals of his life there. And Mimi Sheridan and Frank Priel of the Times put a stringer on the case, and they found this guy, and she proceeded to write a very negative, went and ate there, did not like it, and proceeded to write about it. Now, what was interesting was I had occasion to talk to Mimi very recently, and the phrase she used, that, and I was thinking about this local review, and the phrase she used was it or was it not in the public interest, which was interesting. And the point at that time was this: there was all this exposure in The New Yorker, therefore it was. Also interesting, though, is she only went one time, and it was not a starred review. I don't mean she gave it no stars.
Oh, okay.
I mean it was not a review. It was an article.
Okay.
It read like a review, mm-hmm. but that restaurant was spared, although mm-hmm. it was a devastating event for the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chef at the time said it was like having a nuclear bomb dropped on a little island. That was a quote he gave.
Oh, well, that's the year of Three Mile Island, too.
Well, it was the year of Three Mile Island. But he... But what was interesting to me was it wasn't a review. Like, it existed in this separate little world of its own, you know? And in thinking about what happened with this local review, I could have seen more of a – listen, I'm not putting myself in the same realm as Pete Wells, but, you know, I could – if I was in that position, I think if maybe it was like a critic's notebook type piece and here's what I thought and hopefully it'll get better – as opposed to just a straight reviewing it on the same terms as other restaurants, as if it was just another restaurant. I think that's part of what really rankled people, to me anyway.
Well, maybe it was written to solicit the comments. Because there was a lot of comments.
Yes, got a lot of attention.
He made a lot of comments as well, so he obviously felt strongly about it. I'm sure he went out there with every intention of wanting to like the place. I mean, how could you not? I mean, the altruistic vision of the concept.
100%.
But don't you have to go several times? And wouldn't being objective have you to go to the Watts store? You know, if you're going to do a review, there's a certain criteria that the New York Times are Craig Claiborne have established, and if you're going to eschew that, fine, but maybe that pushes it into, you know, what Andrew was talking about, where Mimi Sheridan did something that would resemble a critic's notebook more so than a review.
Well, I mean, the other thing I will say is he did say in one of these follow-up pieces, and he has made himself available for some of these, he did say the reason he went there was that it was the one he'd read the most about. Right? That's where this public interest thing comes up. That's why, to me,
I could see being out there and wanting to check it out and maybe feeling compelled to write about it. But anyway.
The Oakland store had more press than the Watts store?
Well.
I got to wonder.
We'll keep talking after the show. But I do think it's a fascinating little case study of kind of the intersection of chefs and critics, something we talked about on the show before, Jimmy. But
Pete's right, you know, where it seems to me that everybody's basically saying the same thing, you know. So this isn't a Pete bashing thing. This is, you know, if the food wasn't good, the food wasn't good. And you're a restaurant. Sure, fine. But, you know, again, restaurants are supposed to be graded for more than just the food, you know, which is like gone by the wayside. You know, they used to speak about the way you were served, the way the room felt, the you know, and by that, the way the room felt, the lighting, the music, the flower displays, you know, how the maitre d' greeted you. Basically, a restaurant review these days is there's a chef, and they're great or not great, and this is why. And, you know, why is it called a restaurant review then?
Yeah, well.
Waxing. I'm waxing over
waxing,
here.
Waxing, Jimmy. More than we have time for right now. So we're at the end of our show. It's great to be back on the air. Mark, it was great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming and great meeting you. And
thanks, Jess.
Again, the new business is Pasta Flyer. And when it materializes in lower Manhattan, we hope everyone listening will come and
please come visit.
Support it and check it out. And it proves to be very exciting. And I also think, again, it a lot of... You know, things change. What a restaurant is changes. It's hard sometimes for people around my age to embrace that and get that and just understand that, you know, what a chef does changes, what a restaurant is changes. These are things that are always mutating and evolving naturally. And I think this concept is sort of right in the thick of where things are and where they're going, and I think it's going to be fascinating. So all the best.
Thank you
that.
Very much, Andrew.
You can follow Mark on Twitter at Chef Mark Ladner.
Yes.
You can follow me at Tokeland Andrew, and you can follow Jimmy at Red Cat NYC. And that's it for this show. We're here for the season, and we will see you back soon on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.